This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure and privilege for me to have in the studio Steve Early, a longtime union man with the Communication Workers of America, a freelance journalist and author. He's written for The Progressive and Progressive Media Project. His latest book is The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. Steve Early, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Tell me about the book. What motivated you to write it?
Well, I spent nearly three decades in the Northeast working as a national union organizer and contract negotiator for the Communication Workers of America. So I had a lot of experience dealing with the challenges of union contract negotiations in the private and public sector and the great need of unions in this country to expand their membership so they can better advocate on behalf of all workers. I was very interested in the developments over the last two or three years that are reported in the book, a series of intra-union conflicts involving some of the most progressive unions in the country, unions long identified with a commitment to organizing the unorganized, who unfortunately descended into a kind of carnival of organizational cannibalism, very costly series of disputes that diverted resources and organizational focus from trying to exploit what many people hoped was going to be a political opening or opportunity during the first couple of years of the Obama administration to enact real health care reform and strengthen workers' right to organize and bargain in the private sector.
It was not only progressive unions, but some of the most progressive unionists, people who were of the left, of self-identified progressives, who went into the labor movement in the 70s and 80s to try to bring about real social change. And there was one Cornell University professor who said she must have known 100 people who she had as students, and that they were just fighting among themselves. I mean, it was painful to read.
Yeah, the other aspect of the story that I was interested in was tracing the trajectory of folks in my own generational cohort in the labor movement. I was active in the movement against the war in Vietnam as a college student in the late 70s, got involved in unions in the early 70s when I was in law school, and there was a whole wing of the new left that moved from the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the black power movement, the anti-war movement into labor unions in the 70s, and over the next 20 or 30 years, those folks contributed in many ways to revitalizing a number of unions, and some of them eventually ended up in high-ranking positions. And so it was quite a paradox that in the last few years, folks who started out on the same side of the barricades ended up on opposite sides in some pretty bloody, costly conflicts.
I'm speaking with Steve Early. He's the author of The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine. Costly, you put a price tag at $140 million at the cost of this internecine labor battle.
Yeah, well, when you look at the it's a little bit like estimating the ongoing cost of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But when you look at what was spent on all sides, by the California Nurses Association and the service employees when they were skirmishing for several years. Then there was a big fight in Puerto Rico between the service employees and the militant left-wing-led Puerto Rican Teachers Union. And there was a terrible internal conflict between SEIU's third-largest affiliate, United Healthcare Workers West, and the International Union. And then finally, there was a falling out among two founding unions of the Change to Win Labor Coalition, the Unite Here, the Garment Workers, Hotel Workers Union, and the service employees. When you add it all up, it was a huge amount of money that would have been better spent on organizing the unorganized and holding politicians accountable and building more much-needed community labor coalitions around the country.
One of the common denominators in a lot of those things you just mentioned is the Service Employees International Union, and one person who looms large in your book is Andy Stern, the former head of the SEIU and the guy who led the Change to Win Federation out of the AFL-CIO. What do you make of Stern?
Well, I think he's, to our generational cohort in the labor movement, a little bit like Bill Clinton, a guy with tremendous skills and charisma, a creative leader, inspirational, someone with a great track record of accomplishment. On the other hand, with some very deep flaws, and who ultimately proved, in the same way that Clinton did, to be quite a disappointment, and someone who did not really achieve his full potential as a revitalizer of the labor movement.
The book makes it appear as though he was kind of a destructive influence, though.
Well, I think the service employees deserves credit for developing some very important organizing models. Its Justice for Janitors campaigns have been rightly lauded. It developed this model for organizing home-based workers, workers doing child care or working as home health care aides. That model has been copied by other unions, and as a result, 500,000 or 600,000 home-based workers have been organized in the last 10 years by SEIU and other unions as the largest single source of new union membership. But at a certain point, kind of like Howard Schultz at Starbucks, Stern and SEIU became totally obsessed with growth, opening new outlets, gaining new members at any cost. And the cost began to be pretty high when SEIU started launching raids on other unions and trying to poach their members, and rather than maintaining a focus on organizing the unorganized.
And right now, what is up with Change to Win? Is that group going back to the AFL?
It started out as a seven-union breakaway from the main National Labor Federation, the AFL-CIO, in 2005. Its initial premise was that it was going to be more effective in political action and organizing and other coordinated union activities. Didn't take long for one of the founding unions, the Carpenters, to split away. More recently, the hotel workers have returned to the AFL-CIO and the laborers. So at this point, it's really three main unions, the service employees, the Teamsters, and the United Food and Commercial Workers, with a small group of California farm workers, and has not lived up to its potential or its professed objective of creating a viable alternative to the AFL-CIO. And there's still some joint organizing activity the unions conduct, but you really wouldn't call it a labor federation.
You know, for outsiders looking in, even sympathetic ones like me, it just that move and then all the infighting with the SEIU and other unions and within its union, it just seems like, wow, why are you doing all this divisiveness when there's so much to be done to organize the unorganized, to take on this right-wing assault that's been coming down the pike so fast? And it's just a head-scratcher.
Well, these developments, as I point out in the book, were very dismaying for labor-oriented intellectuals, faculty members on campuses around the country who had gotten involved in supporting labor causes, the many labor-oriented students, activists, and community organizations who'd been allies in campaigns like the Justice for Janitors organizing drives, to see the unions that had been their patrons, that had been examples of better union behavior misbehaving so badly, was very disillusioning. And some of the young people that I profile in the book who had gone to work as organizers for some of the combatants ended up, I think, burning out and turning away from the labor movement as a result of this bitter, disillusioning experience.
And my daughter, who was on campus in Massachusetts during the Sodexo thing, was just confounded and confused by the internal union politics there. I mean, there was an obvious case of exploitation on the part of the company. She got that, and that's what got her interested. And then it was she'd go to these meetings just to know what was coming down.
Yeah, food service, particularly involving contractors like Aramark and Sodexo, who operate on many university campuses, was a major battlefield when the split developed between SEIU and Unite Here. A number of coordinated campaigns that they had previously been conducting together were disrupted, and the unions plunged into very aggressive competition with each other for the same groups of already organized workers who are unorganized workers. And when you have 88% of the workforce unorganized, you would think there'd be enough for everybody to do, meeting the challenges of trying to sign them up as opposed to going after each other's existing dues payers.
I'm speaking with Steve Early. He's the author of this book, The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. He's a longtime union man himself with the Communication Workers of America, and a journalist and author who's written for the Progressive magazine. And you're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild from the Progressive. Let's talk a little bit about the moment that was presented when Obama won. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, Steve. That was an exhilarating moment when the night he was elected. A lot of people never thought a black man would be elected, especially a black man who was fluent and progressive. I mean, the guy speaks progressive, and yet the first couple years of Obama's administration has been a big disappointment to me, and I think to a lot of progressives. Organized labor poured a ton of money and a ton of energy into getting Obama elected. I was shocked to read the figure that you had in this book, that it was $300 million that organized labor put into getting Obama elected. I did a little math. That would be 10,000 organizers for a year at $30,000. That's a huge opportunity cost. And the benefits were what?
Well, any time that we get a Democrat in replacing somebody as bad as George Bush, there are a variety of benefits. The appointments to labor-related federal agencies are better. There's more access to the White House. Top union officials do get to be consulted about policy decisions. But the broad outlines of administration policy, many ways have not been much better than the Clinton administration or the Carter administration before it. And that has been a source of disappointment and disillusionment for many union activists who rang on doorbells and made phone calls to help elect Obama in the fall of 2008. I mean, labor's two highest priorities in 2009 were enacting health care reform and labor law reform as it applied to private sector workers. The health care reform legislation fell short, way short of what's really needed to relieve pressure on union negotiators who are constantly facing demands for concessions in the area of who pays what for medical coverage. And the labor law reform campaign, which was always pushed off until after health care reform, which was supposedly going to lead to passage of a bill called the Employee Free Choice Act, essentially ended up dead on arrival about a year ago when the Democrats lost their 60-vote supermajority in the Senate due to the bad results of the special election in Massachusetts for Ted Kennedy's seat, which was taken by Republican Scott Brown, largely as part of a working-class backlash against aspects of the Obama health care legislation.
I was talking with Dennis Kucinich within the last few weeks, and he said that Obama's failure to push for the Employee Free Choice Act was the a single moment that indicated what was going to happen with the Obama administration. He thought he could have passed it if he put his weight behind it, and the Obama administration didn't do that and kept signaling that it wasn't going to do it. And Kucinich said, look, Wall Street runs the country and the Pentagon runs the country, and Obama has failed to wrestle either of those, confront either of those huge powers, and this was the first indicator.
Well, I think there was a window of opportunity late in 2009 when there was an interim appointment when Ted Kennedy's seat was filled by a Democrat. There were 60 votes, theoretically, to overcome a Republican filibuster. Earlier that year, the Employee Free Choice Act could have been pushed as an element of the original stimulus package. And part of the problem with Labor's campaign was it was too easily pigeonholed as special interest legislation only benefiting unions as institutions, not workers generally. And it really needed to be framed in terms of the impact of the original Wagner Act, which it was designed to strengthen and amend, which was passed in the 1930s during the depths of the Great Depression, when policymakers realized that workers needed a boost in their purchasing power. They needed the ability to bargain for better wages and benefits, and that could actually have a stimulating effect on the economy. And the fact that labor law reform was severed from that framework very early on was certainly a signal that the Obama administration was going to treat it as special interest legislation, and never really got around to even dealing with it once the health care reform battle was over.
And it just seems to me, Steve Early, that the Obama administration has a real, you know, arm's length at least distance from the labor movement. I read something where it says it doesn't want to be too closely associated with the labor movement. It doesn't want to even come out and support the public sector workers in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and New Jersey and other places because it's worried it's going to be tagged as, you know, this instrument of the labor movement, when in fact, you know, the labor movement not deserves the support because it gave them so much support. But on top of that, the people are behind the labor movement. I mean, the people are behind public sector workers. So it's a win for him if he would do it, but he's so reluctant to do it.
It is a pretty serious dissing of a major segment of his own grassroots base, and he may not be able to count on some of these folks in his reelection campaign as a result. Certainly, he sent some wrong signals to governors, both Republican and Democrat, early on when he froze federal workers' pay for 2 years, making only a small dent in the federal budget deficit, and you know, proceeded to aid and abet the attack on teachers and their contract standards and job rights. And I mean, there have been a number of measures that he's taken that sent mixed signals at best about his attitude towards organized labor. And as you say, he had an opportunity in the last month or so to speak out about the principle of collective bargaining, which is certainly at risk now in the public sector in states like Wisconsin, and he didn't really do that.
Steve Early, what do you make of this upsurge in activism among public sector workers and supporters of public sector workers?
Well, I think it's a tremendous turnaround in what we were told was the direction of public sentiment as recently as late last year and early this year. A lot of the mass media was playing up divisions within the working class, was highlighting the degree to which private sector workers facing cuts in their own jobs and benefits and pay were becoming deeply resentful of the supposedly more privileged class of public employees. Clearly, there was an effort to pit these two groups of workers against each other. And one of the most amazing and encouraging things that we've seen everywhere in the country, viewing the events here in Cairo by the lake in Wisconsin, has been the unity of workers from both the private and public sector, the support they've gotten from students in the community, the fact that people have come together in a almost unprecedented display of community labor solidarity.
What accounts for it, do you think?
Well, I think certainly the degree of the attack, Governor Walker's legislation, you know, turns back the clock more than 50 years. So it's a pretty serious wake-up call. People clearly didn't know that it was coming when Walker was campaigning last fall. It was not a well-advertised part of his program. So I think it was the shock effect of waking up and realizing that a lot of people would lose here, either through budget cuts or diminishing the standard of living of tens of thousands of people employed by state and local government, that private sector workers would be affected next. And virtually all segments of the community had something to lose unless they united to fend off these assaults.
And let's just talk worst case and assume that this Walker bill does ultimately become law, it becomes implemented. The really underreported aspects of the bill that really get after collective bargaining rights are not just disallowing anything collective bargaining except for wages at the rate of inflation, but actually assaults on the union themselves by stripping unions, making it illegal for any public employer to deduct union dues from a worker's paycheck. That's a defunding of the union. And then this requirement that every public sector union needs to recertify and have an election every year to say, yes, we still want to be in the union. Those are things that go right at the existence and survivability of unions. Can the labor union movement respond to that?
Well, it's going to be a serious challenge. The model that Governor Walker here in Wisconsin, Governor Kasich in Ohio seem to be working off of is Indiana, where Mitch Daniels, a Republican, got in 6 years ago and stripped public sector workers of their bargaining rights. Among state workers, not only were jobs cut, but union membership plummeted from about 16,000 at the time that he took over to less than 2,000 today. And there is a reason for dues deduction through the employer, and that is so that everybody pays their fair share of the representation that union members get and pay their fair share of the cost of negotiating contracts and lobbying and so forth. When the scope of bargaining is greatly reduced, when unions are limited in what they can do in the workplace as a representative of workers, people have much less reason to pay for union services. And so the unions are going to have to recast themselves as a different kind of workplace organization, hopefully inspired by the model of the mass protests that we've seen in Madison recently. They're going to have to rely much more on direct action. They're going to have to rely much more on developing rank-and-file leadership and networks of stewards, because the traditional model of relying on full-time officials, lawyers, lobbyists, and automatically collecting dues with the help of the employer, it's not going to be there in the worst-case scenario that's shaping up in states like Wisconsin and Ohio.
And so it's going to have to change the whole way the unions function. You write about this in your book, Steve Early, The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor, that there's been this kind of stratification within the unions and this distance between the members and the professional staff, which you have found corrosive. And so to some extent, I mean, oddly, it might be a helpful thing. I mean, it's going to be destructive of the ability to function on the financial end. But if it's a wake up to unions to say, look, we can't operate this way anymore. We got to make people realize why the union's valuable, so they are actually voluntarily cough up the dues every 2 weeks or every month. I don't know how that collection's going to happen, though. How do unions in the South, for instance, collect dues?
Well, there are a number of state employee organizations, several backed by my own union alma mater, the Communication Workers in Mississippi and Texas. There's another group backed by the United Electrical Workers in North Carolina. They all operate in states where there is no, never has been any collective bargaining in the public sector. Union membership is entirely voluntary. And in all three states, there are thousands of public employees who voluntarily pay to support a membership organization that advocates for them in the workplace, that lobbies in the legislature, that organizes protests and meetings and functions like a union. I mean, you don't need the legal framework that is currently being stripped to still have a union. And this reinvention of unions as membership organizations, I mean, we've seen that process underway with the mass protest activity in Madison. There are models in other parts of the country, and the unions in the Midwest and the northern states that are facing these kinds of challenges are going to have to emulate their southern brothers and sisters.
And Steve Early, what about this annual recertification, these annual elections? How threatening is that, or is that easy to get a majority?
Well, I think initially, certainly in the wake of this legislation going into effect, and in some cases in Wisconsin, that impact is going to be delayed until current contracts expired. You know, this will be a hurdle that can be overcome, but it's clearly designed to create an opportunity for public sector management to get much more involved in opposing this recertification and weighing in against a continued unionization in the way that many private sector employers have done. And that has not been public sector management behavior in the past. Most public agency administrators in most states with our collective bargaining rights have stayed out of union representation votes, have not intervened the way that private industry does. And I think this is opening the door for a change in that kind of management behavior. So some of these votes might be quite hotly contested.
And not to put too fine a point on it, but when the private sector management intervenes in these elections, it often does so illegally. It fires organizers. It threatens workers who want to join a union. And there's essentially no penalty for them. I mean, they rarely get prosecuted. To the extent that they get convicted, they're barely fined. I mean, it's a joke what's happened to the labor laws in this country.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why teachers and firefighters and police officers and state workers around the country 30, 40, or 50 years ago, depending on which state you're talking about, decided that bare-bones civil service protections weren't sufficient. It didn't provide enough due process when there was unfair discipline, didn't give them enough of a voice in negotiating their determining their pay and their benefits. And that's why collective bargaining laws were enacted and why contract negotiations over the years have improved the status of public employees. So I think when you revert to the conditions that existed before, there's a lot more job insecurity, and individual union activists may start facing some of the risks that are very familiar, unfortunately, to their counterparts in the private sector.
Mm-hmm. There was a poll out by Peter Hart a couple of years ago that said 60 million people would join a union if they could, if they weren't worried about being fired or somehow being penalized. I thought that was an astonishing figure, and maybe that shows – maybe it's not surprising these later polls that came out this year that say people actually favor unions, people actually favor public sector unions, but they're just worried that if they join, they're going to – or try to join, they're going to be penalized.
Management interference is the critical factor in organizing campaigns, and the unfettered ability of employers to fire, harass, intimidate, demote, unfairly transfer workers in retaliation for their exercising their legal right to form or join a union is a major obstacle to union growth.
Another obstacle we're seeing in the public sector here is just eliminating categories of workers who can legally join a public sector worker, child care workers, TAs in the academy and things like that. And that's going to have a bad effect, isn't it?
Yeah. One of the great advances in union membership over the past 10 years were the successful organizing campaigns led by the service employees and other unions involving home-based workers, publicly financed providers of daycare and home health aid services working in their own homes or other folks' homes. About 600,000 of these workers were organized around the country. They used to be classified unfairly and wrongly as independent contractors. They were able to form bargaining units, negotiate some initial contracts, very bare-bones agreements. They weren't covered by traditional public employee pension or health plans. Still, many of these folks are working for near minimum wage. We're talking about women, people of color, sometimes foreign-born workers, and about 50,000 of them have been stripped of their newly won bargaining rights just since January. If you add up, you know, what's happened to them in Michigan, now in Wisconsin, and in Ohio as well.
And so they're losing their representation, they're losing their voice, and they'll probably lose money too.
And more importantly, for people who have children who want to have elder care so that a family member who's disabled or chronically ill could be cared for at home as opposed to a nursing facility, the programs that provide home health services through Medicaid budget cuts are being curtailed around the country. So it's not just the workers themselves who provide this important direct care with very little recognition, respect, or compensation, but the millions of Americans who may not be poor who depend on this kind of help at home.
We have about 30 seconds left. Steve, do you see some solidarity then across not only occupations but people who use the services of these home care workers and other people understand what public sector workers do?
I think so. When you know, people in the community can come together with the providers of public services, the situation of public employee unions and their members is obviously much stronger than if public sector collective bargaining is seen as a special interest group activity that only benefits the workers themselves and not the people they serve.
Well, it's been fun having you as a guest today, Steve Early. Steve Early is the author of The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Thanks for having me on.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.